ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to The Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. The Green Dot is sponsored by Crew Chief Systems, the smarter way to manage, maintain, and safeguard your aircraft's value. I'm Tom Charpentier, Government Relations Director here at EAA, and across from me is...
Connor Madison, Staff Photographer.
Connor, have we ever done one of these together before?
I don't know if you and I have.
I don't think we have. Yeah, cool. Okay, well, this will be fun.
Yeah.
And it'll especially be fun because our guest today is somebody who is... not unfamiliar to those of us here at EAA because he's one of our coworkers. Does a lot of work with aviation safety here at EAA, and also has a very very important role with pretty much all ground operations during during convention. But he has some very unique stories that I don't think we've ever really gotten out of him before. So he's here today to tell us about that. So Dick Hanusa, welcome to the Green Dot.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
So how do you want to get rolling here?
Yeah, so real tough question. Just kind of tell us how you got inspired to be interested in aviation in the first place.
Well, Connor, it's actually kind of a interesting question because I almost call myself the accidental aviator. I grew up here in Oshkosh, and after high school, I wasn't college material at all. So I decided and got a job, worked at a local factory here in Oshkosh, and it looked like I was, it was during the Vietnam era. It looked like I was probably going to possibly get drafted. So myself, fellow classmate of mine from high school, Dan Lipke, we went down to the recruiter and we're looking at things at the Army recruiter. And he was in talking to the recruiter. They had a pamphlet, a bunch of pamphlets listed in a folder on the wall. And I was looking through them because I had no idea what I wanted to be or what I wanted to do, and grabbed one that had a helicopter picture on it. I thought, well, that looks interesting. So I opened it up and start reading what it said and what you had to do. And I thought, well, that looks like that'd be fun. So I went in and talked to the recruiter, and he said, well, you have to do this and this and this, take some aptitude tests and pass a physical and stuff like that. And somehow, and had a review board by some Army officers, and somehow I got through all of that and signed up to go to flight school, courtesy of the U.S. Army.
Excellent.
That's kind of how I kicked it off. So,
and of course, growing up in Oshkosh back then, that was before EAA was in Oshkosh, so Oshkosh didn't necessarily mean airplanes.
No, that's correct. In fact, I grew up on the north side of Oshkosh, and so I never really was associated or affiliated or even went to the airport for anything because it wasn't part of a lifestyle or anything at that time. Never had flown an aircraft in my life or anything like that. So it was just interesting for me how I got into it. And once I got into it, I found to love it, and I've been doing it ever since. So 57 years later, still enjoying and flying. So that's the cool part of it for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome. So I guess tell us, when you got into Army flight school then, how did, tell us about the progression, how that went.
Yeah, the Army had basic primary flight training, they called it, at Fort Walters, Texas, Mineral Wells, west of Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I trained in a TH-55, which was a Hughes 300 or Hughes 269. And you progressed, and some things I do remember specifically. There are snippets of things that I really remember. The two important things, learning to fly helicopters, number one, learning how to hover. Number two, learning how to do auto rotations. And number one, I struggled with hovering. Number two, I struggled with auto rotations. But I remember one flight, they gave me a senior flight instructor. We were at a stage field, and the stage field was surrounded by this high chain link fence. And he took me and he said, okay, let's hover over here. He hovered over. He took me to the corner of the stage field where the chain link fence met, and set the aircraft down. He said, okay, pick it up. You're going to hover here. And with the chain link fence on the side of me and in front of me with some trees on the other side, I learned to hover real quickly. That's how I learned to hover. After that, it was like, wow. I can do this. And it's kind of the same with auto-rotations. Auto-rotations is when the helicopter, if you have an engine failure, you have to auto-rotate. And when you get down close to the ground, you have to flare and you have to cushion the landing with the energy that's in the rotor blades. And you have to time it quite exactly. And once I got that down, progressed, then continued to solo. And then we did a lot of cross-country flight training and stuff like that to get the primary part of it out of the way, which was about the first 100 hours of flight training was there in Texas. Then after that, I went to Fort Rucker, Alabama, which is now called Fort Novosel, and transitioned, did instrument training there in the Bell 47 or TH-13T, and then transitioned into the Huey. And once you transitioned to the Huey and got qualified, then we started doing tactical training, a lot of formation flight training and training into small LZs and stuff in lower Alabama there and that part of it. So we called it, like I said, affectionately, Mother Rucker or L.A., lower Alabama. So, and that's progressed from there. And once I graduated from flight school, got my warrant officer bars 1 year to the day that I had started flying at in flight school, and 8 months and 1 day later, I got my wings. So flight school was very fast, very compressed, you were so busy, you didn't really have time to think about anything else but studying academics and learning to fly. And with 200 hours of flight time, I was an Army aviator.
And Dick, this is, it was, I guess, kind of unique because during this time, you know, it was a few years into the Vietnam War at the time, right? I think you said 67, 68-ish.
Yeah, that's when I went to flight school, yes.
So today we know Vietnam as the helicopter war. Obviously, like the Huey is perhaps the most iconic vehicle of the entire conflict. And you were learning to fly right in the middle of that as the tactics were being developed and, you know, obviously the war was going on. Were any of your instructors coming back? Did they have experience in country?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That basically, all the instructors I had, both at primary flight training and at Fort Rucker in advanced and Huey training, they were all Vietnam veterans. And that's how they handed or, you know, taught us new aviators to fly and use the experiences that they had gone through to explain this is why you do things this way and this is what happens and this is what happens if you don't do it right. And so that was very, very, very valuable during our flight training. Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably good that you weren't in one of the very first classes, had to figure it all out on your own.
Yeah, definitely. That's for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
So a question for you about, I was recently reading an article about someone that had was just learning how to fly the helicopter. And they said, like at the beginning with learning to hover, it was like it forever, it didn't click. And then all of a sudden it just clicked. I mean, it kind of sounds like that's how it was for you.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, I was struggling with hovering. And the problem is that you would over control the aircraft and it would start going back and forth and side to side. And the more it did it, the more you over controlled and the oscillations just kept getting worse and worse. And you had to figure out how just to hold the cyclic very kind of lightly and just give it very almost so subtle movements you didn't even realize you were moving it. And like I said, with that IP putting me in the corner by the fence, that taught me real quick to get rid of them big movements and get the very finite movements controlling the cyclic. And once you get that down, it's kind of like some people pick it up more quickly than others. It's kind of like watching somebody learn to ride a bicycle. Some people hop on and can do it. Some people take them a little bit longer. But once you get it, you don't forget it.
Mm-hmm. So you... as you said, flight training was fairly abbreviated because the war was on and you were on your way. So were you then assigned to a unit stateside and trained with them, or did you go straight to in-country?
No, straight to Vietnam. I was home for 2 weeks after graduating from flight school, and then I was on my way to Vietnam and arrived in Vietnam and right after the first year of 1969. And the first thing I remember getting off that big brand of orange 747 was when they opened the door and you walked out, you were just hit with this wave of heat that like you'd never felt before. It was hot and humid. It's kind of like if you open your oven after it's been on, that blast of heat you get, that's basically, I remember, that's kind of what it felt like. And once I got in country, they assign you to a unit based on the needs of the individual units. And I was assigned to the 1st Air Cav Division. And in the 3rd Brigade, I was assigned actually to Head and Headquarters Company of the 3rd Brigade, which I feel was fortunate for me because it was a small unit. We had 5 Hueys and 8 Loaches, and we flew combat control, and we flew liaison with the Loaches and also scout missions with the Loaches. And so being in a smaller unit, like for me personally, I think it was advantageous. You got to the unit and you got to fly 2 different types of aircraft relatively quickly. And the old guys, we called them, that had been there maybe 6 months, they mentored us new guys when we got in country. And that's really what kind of saved a lot of us, is the mentorship, because we learned, 200-hour pilot, you're in a combat situation, and one day you're in flight school, and the next day, and let's say a month after I graduated from flight school, I was flying combat missions in Vietnam. So it was that kind of a very sudden transition.
Yeah, those 6-month old timers.
Yeah. Oh, that's, yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. If you made it 6 months, you were an old timer.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned the Huey, and I think most of our listeners are probably pretty familiar with the Huey. Can you tell us about the Loach you've mentioned a few times?
Yeah, the Loach, the Army called it the OH-6. It was a Cayuse, and it was built by Hughes Aircraft, and it was a 4-bladed rotor system. It looked like the little egg-shelled aircraft with a, and it was the most fun aircraft I've ever flown, to be honest with you. Very maneuverable, very quick. It's like kind of like driving a sports car. It would respond quickly and responsive, and it's just a lot of fun to fly. And if I had one aircraft that I could own, it would probably be a Loach, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I've heard it described as it's almost like kind of the pits of the Pit special of the, yeah, the helicopter world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I think it's from Hugh Mills' book where they talk about like actually flying it. It was sensitive enough that you could put the skid like into a foxhole if you wanted. Like it was that sensitive control input.
Yeah. Yeah. The Loach. Yeah. Yeah. The Loach was. Yeah. And it was when we flew it on scout missions, we had a minigun mounted on it and we had a door gunner in the back. And the door gunner had an M60 machine gun. He had a M40, like a chunker, we called it. And he had many different colored smoke grenades and Willie Pete grenades in the back. So if we found a target or found something, he could quickly toss the grenade out to mark it for if we had anybody escorting us, like Cobras or anything like that, so we could mark the target for them. Or if we could get some Air Force or, you know, other fighter jets come in, we could mark the targets for them that way with that. But the Loach was, the other thing about it being shaped like an egg, it was a very survivable aircraft. It would roll up in a ball, but the frame and the structure of it, even though it looked like it had a lot of plexiglass, it would take a whole lot of damage and still get you back home. And that was the other good part about it.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry if you mentioned it already. Did you fly the Loach before you were in Vietnam? Or?
No. I transitioned in the Loach in March in Vietnam. I transitioned then, and I kind of pinched myself at the time because it was so much fun to fly. But can you imagine? You know, the Army giving a 20-year-old kid a helicopter of his own, and okay, go on. This is your mission today. Go do it.
Yeah,
it was kind of a, you know, but that's what they did. They entrusted us to the training they gave us, and we'd go out and they'd give us a job, and that's what we do.
Wow, that's incredible. It's a funny contrast to a lot of the other aviators we've talked to from different branches. You know, certainly if you talk to a naval aviator, you know, well, you don't just go to the squadron. You do your training, then you go to the transitional unit, then you go to your squadron, then you go to combat, and here you're basically doing the transition training right there on the front lines.
Yeah. At the time, the Army was really short on helicopter pilots, actually. And they didn't have time to have you trained in the States. They trained you and you got OJT there in Vietnam is what it came down to.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's why it was important, the mentors, the older guys. The first guy I flew with, Jim Petritis, he was basically my mentor in the Huey, and they told you what to do. They taught you how to, you know, fly in the combat, how to get in and out of LZs, how to get in and out of hovering LZs where you have to hover straight up and down. So they were the ones that taught us how to really fly. And without those guys doing that for us, and that's what you did. After you'd been there for a while and you became an aircraft commander, you took new pilots that came into your unit and flew with them and passed the same thing on to them. That was how it worked at that time.
Yeah. And before we move too much farther into the interview here and your stories, we should probably talk about where were you actually in Vietnam during this time?
I was in, at the time, Vietnam was divided into four corps. They call them tactical. I was in the third corps, and we were northwest of Saigon, up by the Cambodian border. I was based at a place called Quan Loi. A couple times over there, we actually moved the whole, it was an air cavalry, so they would actually move the units around a lot. And we moved to Benoit. We moved to another place called Black Horse. But I spent back to Quan Loi most of my time in a place called Quan Loi, up near the Cambodian border.
And that was one thing, you know, before this interview, we were looking at the map a little bit. And it's kind of an area that's kind of northwest of Saigon. And you think, wait a minute, the DMZ is all the way, you know, many, many miles to the north. But you're right there along the Ho Chi Minh Trail where there was a lot of activity.
Yeah, that's basically what all of our American units that were, you know, in that area along the Cambodian border, our job basically was to prevent the NVA and the Viet Cong from getting to Saigon. I mean, that was their goal. They wanted to, you know, get to Saigon and overthrow the government. So that's why we were out where we were. And we were, very close to the Cambodian border. And that's why we would come under attack a lot in the And the guys on the ground, the infantry guys and people on the ground, they were trying to hold the ground and keep the NVA and Viet Cong from advancing. And they were the guys that really took the brunt of, you know, what's going on out there. I felt lucky actually being a helicopter pilot because we'd take these guys and drop them off out in the jungle and they'd be out there for a week or two, maybe 3 weeks at a time. The only way they had of getting anything in and out to them was us with helicopters, providing them ammo, food, whatever it would be, you know, evacuating the wounded. And the only way they had to get out of there was either by foot or by helicopter. So that was the difference of the war. Unfortunately, we had, from that standpoint, we had air superiority there in South Vietnam. So we really didn't, with the helicopters, we really didn't have to worry about other enemy, you know, aircraft, you know, coming and fighting or attacking. All of our combat situations were based on the ground operations and ground, ground fire and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So how long was your first tour there?
It was a year. Basically, I left Oakland, California, like on the 26th, 27th of December, and I got back 26th, 27th of December of 1969. So like I said, I left in 1968, and I got to my unit because my first flight, like I said, looking back at my flight records, was January 4th of 1969, basically a month after I had graduated from flight school.
Huh. And so that entire year, was that was with the same unit then?
Yeah, I was with the 1st CAV and headquarters company of the 3rd Brigade and spent the whole time there. And like I said, we moved around a little bit, but the 1st CAV was very interesting because it was large. It was a division, large organization, had actually 3 brigades, and the brigades have battalions that have all the infantry troops and stuff in them. And those are the people, that's why we were there, for those people to support them. Mm-hmm. And like I said, they had the hardest job of all. Like I said, they'd be placed out in the jungle, and they'd be out there for 2-3 weeks at a time, maybe longer. And they didn't have, that was it. They were out in the field, you know, trying to hold the ground that we had or try to advance. And Vietnam was kind of a unique war because the Viet Cong and the NVA, they'd been fighting a long time actually in Vietnam, and they had a huge tunnel complexes all over the country. And they, some of those tunnels were big enough that they could like drive vehicles in them, but they would have their compounds and everything underground. And so they would plan their attacks, whatever they were going to do. They'd come up out of the tunnels lots of times, most times at night is when really a lot of attacks occurred. They'd attack and they'd be either shooting rockets or mortars or just ground fire attacking the ground troops. And then after things, if they didn't advance or didn't get what they wanted, things got too hot for them. We started bringing, you know, gunships in to shoot at, you know, to fire and get Air Force bombers to come in and drop bombs. They would just disappear into the tunnels. So that was why it was a very difficult war, I think, for the ground troops. I wasn't a ground troop, but I didn't envy them at all because the enemy would appear and then they'd disappear. And that made it very challenging, I think, for those guys, you know, fighting.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we continue, we'd like to take a minute to thank our sponsor, Crew Chief Systems. Are you still relying on paper logs or manual spreadsheets to manage your aircraft? It's time to elevate your approach. Crew Chief Systems puts your airplane at the center of real-time aircraft asset intelligence, allowing you to fly safer, save time, and protect your aircraft's value. Crew Chief's intuitive platform unifies all of your maintenance, compliance, and operational data, giving you instant access to your aircraft's full history, upcoming requirements, and real-time insights directly from your mobile device or computer. Whether you're a pilot, fleet manager, or mechanic, Crew Chief Systems helps you stay compliant, make smarter decisions, and keep your aircraft in peak condition. Visit crewchiefsystems.com to see how you can modernize your aircraft management. And as a special thank you to Green Dot listeners, save 15% for the lifetime of your Crew Chief GA subscription when you use the coupon code GREEN15, that's GREEN15, at crewchiefsystems.com. Thanks again to Crew Chief Systems for sponsoring the Green Dot. Okay, well, we're going at a very fast clip through this episode here, so I guess we better get over to what was your most memorable mission on that or memorable flight on that first tour?
Well, I guess I had several of them. One that was memorable, a little bit tragic. I started flying scouts, and we had two scouts, two low birds, and the high bird. I was flying the high bird with an observer, and we would gather the intelligence that the scouts were seeing. And the scout lead got shot down by a 50 caliber NVA weapon. And so while number two was trying to put some ground fire down where they got shot down, I called in tried to get some Cobras and some other gunships in to see if they could take out that 50 cal. And while I was doing that, two of my other buddies from my unit, Greg Ash and Byron Bodie, grabbed a Loach and flew to the site, picked up the pilot and the door gunner, and flew him back to the base. And unfortunately, the pilot on that got shot in the leg and was badly injured. And unfortunately, the door gunner was wounded and was burned and passed away 2 days later. So. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of things that sort of stick in your mind a little bit. But we were flying over there so much every day, you basically forgot about the previous day very quickly. I flew over almost 1,100 combat hours while I was over there. And two of the months I flew over 140 hours those months, combat missions. And when situations occurred like that, like I said, there's sort of a suddenness about combat that one day you're sitting around drinking a beer with your buddies, and the next day, unfortunately, they're injured or medevaced or they're gone. And you have to move on from that. the next day get back in your aircraft and you go do the mission that you're assigned there. So that's kind of a unique thing about combat situation, that anybody I think has been in combat, they'll tell you that the suddenness of how things occur, it can, it's just very quick. And the other thing, like I said, I felt the safest I felt over there was when I was flying. So I wanted to fly as many days as I could, because the ground attacks and the rocket and mortar attacks were, I was more anxious about them than I ever was in the air. And a lot of our missions in our unit, since we were a small unit, they were single ship missions. Either with the Loach, you do single ship missions, or the Huey, we were single ship. We'd go out to a battalion that was based at a fire base. We'd be assigned to that battalion during the day. Battalion commander would want to go visit his troops, or if they started fighting, get in contact with the enemy, they needed things. They needed supplies. They needed ammunition. They needed people medevaced. And that's what we did. We'd kind of do that on a daily basis, basically. And so like one day would roll into another. A couple missions I do recall. One was I was flying with a brigade commander on board, and we got a call that one of the local indigenous South Vietnamese, I'm going to call them, they're sort of the Viet Cong of the South Vietnamese. They were in a truck. They hit a landmine in a very remote area on a road that was surrounded by jungle and bamboo and everything like that. And there wasn't any other troops around them. So they wanted somebody to go in and pick them up. So we decided to go in and pick them up. And it was an area that was very dense with the bamboo, especially. And in a situation like that, we just had to go in and land and chop the bamboo down as we were going in with our rotor blades, kind of an inverted lawnmower technique. But that's how you'd get into a site. We picked up these severely wounded soldiers and medevaced them back. So those kind of things you remember. I had another mission that I was on where I was flying, and we were heading back home, and got a mayday call from a Cobra that had got shot down. And we were very close. We're the closest ship to them. So we went in to rescue them, and they had crash landed in a big, tall bamboo again. And we went in, found the ship. We were hovering alongside the ship. My crew chief was ready to jump to the ground so they could grab the pilot and the co-pilot and load them on board. And something on the Cobra blew up, and it actually blew my aircraft sideways and damaged it very badly. It started vibrating so bad, and I couldn't, I had difficulty maintaining control of the aircraft. And there was a little opening about a half mile away from where we were. So I had to go set the aircraft down because it didn't want to fly anymore. So we ended up, parking the aircraft out there in this jungle area and waiting for, somebody hopefully to come rescue us. That was one good thing about it being a helicopter war, is that there were a lot of helicopters in the air. And if you made a mayday call, you could hopefully feel that somebody was going to come pick you up relatively quickly. But the unusual thing for me about that mission was I remember the explosion. I remember landing my helicopter. Everybody in my crew was safe. But after that, I don't remember anything after that about what happened. I don't remember being rescued. I don't remember how I got back to the unit or anything. I find it very mystifying to me exactly what occurred once we got on the ground. It's kind of a strange situation.
Sheesh.
That's crazy. Were there any other instances where you had to land, out on a mission, where it was a mayday call?
Well, fortunately, that was the only aircraft I lost my entire tour over there. I had aircraft that were other damaged. The rotor blade shot up and the aircraft shot up, but that was the only one I ever lost. But again, I didn't lose any crew members, and that was another thing. I was very fortunate. I never lost any crew members while I was flying my whole tour over there. So that was important to me. So
absolutely, yeah. So you came back from Vietnam, I believe. You then went on to be an instructor pilot in the helicopter.
Yes.
So you were now one of those old timers passing along knowledge to the next batch.
Yeah. I went to Fort Rucker, Alabama again, and I got back in a week after I got back. My wife and I got married, so I didn't have time to think about a whole lot other than to listen to her tell me where I had to be to get married. So then we went to Alabama, yeah, and I was in flight instructor there for about a year and a half. And then the Army said, well, we're going to send you to fixed wing school. And the only caveat is you got to go back to Vietnam. And so I was looking at the trade-off, and at the time, there was a lot of pilots out there, and my wife and I discussed and said, okay, well, that's what we'll do. So I went to fixed wing training in the Army and ended up flying U-21's radio research electronic surveillance airplanes, my second tour in Vietnam. The U-21's a baby King Air, basically, is what it is. And we had a very interesting mission because we carried linguists on board. And we'd have three linguists on board the aircraft, and we had electronic technology that they would, the radios, they were able to intercept the radio communications by the NVA primarily, is who they were listening to, and the Viet Cong. And this was up in northern South Vietnam, right up close to the DMZ. I was at Wei Phu Bai first, and then we moved to Da Nang when it got kind of too dangerous to be in Wei Phu Bai. And but the linguists would listen to the people on the ground. They knew them by voice, sound, and dialect. And in fact, they'd give them all nicknames and so they could keep track of who they were. And we would track the units that way. And we also had the capability of, we'd fly basically an arc or a big circle around the area, and we could electronically mark where they were talking from, and we would plot that on a map, and then we'd turn that in as surveillance or intelligence gathering information that could be, you know, passed on. That was what that mission was about.
So that's really interesting. So I think some of our listeners may be aware of, but a lot probably aren't, that there is, to this day, an Army fixed wing component. We generally...
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Quite large still. And a lot of it still has to do with electronic surveillance. But at that time, the Army had Caribous back then, had Mohawks, and P-2Vs that were Neptunes that were electronic surveillance. So the Army had a lot.
I didn't know that one.
Well,
yeah.
And the Army even had C-47s, because I flew, when I came back to the States, I flew a C-47 while I was in the Army also. So we had quite a lot of fixed-wing aircraft for support and transportation and support, you know, carrying cargo-type missions directly for the Army, yeah.
Wow. And I also want to just ask, going back to to where you were up by the DMZ, when you were getting those fixes on, you know, the folks that were down on the ground sending those communications, how were you navigating? Were you using TACAN to figure that out?
No, we had an early version, basically, I want to call it, of a GPS type, a very, very early version of navigation. It was so sensitive. It was in the airplane, and it had to be... the gyros and stuff had to sit on the ground like 30 minutes without anybody on the aircraft to get everything spun up, and it would locate the latitude and longitude. And then once we got in the air, that's how we knew exactly where we were.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Huh. Yeah, because I'd imagine when you're doing...
It was called an inertial navigation system.
An IMS.
And it was totally, yeah. And it was this was back in 1972, and they had developed that before then, but that was where INS came from, it was very sensitive back then. And then when I was working for the FAA and with the airlines, they had their INSs, and when I flew 75s and 767s, it was like, wow, I did this a long time ago. I had the INSs.
Yeah. So your second tour then, is that another year long tour?
Yeah, that was basically another year. Mm-hmm. And I was over there, and when they signed the peace treaty, and interestingly enough, since our aircraft had a lot of sensitive and classified equipment on, I got to lead two flights of our aircraft. We didn't leave them in Vietnam. We flew them to Singapore. So from Vietnam, we flew to Bangkok, Thailand, and then from there down to Singapore. So that was kind of my first international flying as a fixed-wing pilot in the Army, figuring out how to do that, because nobody in the unit I was in had done it before, and I was an instrument examiner. So they said, okay, you got to go talk to the Air Force guys and figure out how to do this. So I did, and we didn't get lost, so it worked out well.
And one more thing that we had just discussed before this was, you said when you were up by the DMZ, you weren't shot at yourself, but you were definitely witnessing that around you, right?
Yeah.
Some of the aircraft.
Yeah, because up there they had the NVA had the SAM missiles. And in fact, a month before I arrived in the unit, one of our U-21s was doing a mission up by the DMZ, and unfortunately a SAM shot it down. And but also there was the fighters and bombers that were going into North Vietnam. If they get hit by SAMs, they would come back out south towards South Vietnam and toward the South China Sea out there. And a lot of they'd get Mayday calls. And I remember circling two or three different crews that got shot down and had to eject out of the aircraft into the South China Sea until they could get like Jolly Green helicopters from Da Nang to come and pick them up. So I remember that. That's a whole nother facet of the war that, you know, a lot of different people did a lot of different jobs that is, you know, pretty amazing times.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Yeah, another question about those style missions. What altitudes would you fly at for that?
The electronic surveillance missions, we usually flew about 10,000 feet on those missions. Obviously, it kept us out of any ground fire issues or anything like that. We didn't have to worry about, you know, small weapons or ground fire or anything like that.
So then after your second tour, you come back, and then did you have another job in the Army after that, right?
Yeah, I actually stayed in the Army active duty for 14 years. I flew in out of Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland, did 3 years in Germany flying C-12s, Hueys, and Sabreliners with the Air Force.
Wow.
Out of Stuttgart, Germany, and that was a very, very enjoyable tour because we flew all over Europe, North Africa, and the missions were every day. It was just very, very enjoyable and very educational. It broadened, you know, my flying skills again, took them to another level that I didn't have, you know, before I got there, and that was good. And then when I left active duty, I actually worked for the Department of Defense for a while, and then the FAA, but I also stayed in the Army Reserve, and I flew Hueys and Blackhawks. I was in a total of 29 years in the Army and retired from that and did that. So it was, you know, the Army was very good to me, starting out with a picture on a little pamphlet years ago in a recruiter's office. So,
wow. That's a pretty amazing career. And then after that, you went on to a job with the FAA, right?
Yeah, I worked with FAA for almost 20 years also. And it was very good for me because I had been flying primarily all in the military all those years. And the FAA taught me a whole lot about the whole GAA and civilian side of aviation, from just regular GAA flying to banner towing to crop dusting to helicopter operations, you know, the aero ambulance. I had a lot to do with that because of my helicopter background, and also with Part 135 and Part 121 airlines, air carriers. So, and I got a lot of good training in the FAA flying larger aircraft, and then also working with airlines and doing that. And also that's how I got connected here back to Oshkosh with the air show. I was the inspector in charge here for Air Venture from like 1985 until I retired in 2003. And so that's how after I retired, I started volunteering here and then started working here. So I've been basically with EAA and Air Venture, been associated with for 40 years, fortunately.
came back to our side after you retired, huh?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's awesome.
That's great. And just a little bit about what you do today with your consulting work.
Yeah, my consulting work, do two things. I'm a designated pilot examiner, so I give flight tests to people who want to get their pilot certificates. And I also consult doing audit projects on airlines around the world for IATA, basically the International Air Transportation Association. And that has taken me, just many different places around the world. And it's just been a great opportunity to meet a lot of different people. And in fact, I was doing an audit in China, and I met a gentleman that from the that had in China had been in Cambodia the same time I was in Vietnam, and we got to talk, and we were in the same area. And he said, "Yeah, we were listening to your radio transmissions too." So it was very very kind of interesting meeting somebody from the other side, if you know what I mean, in a situation like that. So,
well, that's. It's a remarkable life in aviation, Dick. And
well, I just feel I've truly been blessed, honestly, that I've been able to enjoy and do all the different things I've been able to enjoy in aviation, and I still love it. I love to go flying. I like to get out in the RV-12 and go take it out flying. That's my relaxation, and I just love it.
Yeah. So Dick is well known to all of us here at EAA, both from the work that he does with the organization and also as you mentioned, the being a designated pilot examiner. I think most of the folks who have gotten their pilot certificate here at EAA have taken their check rides with you. So it's you're a very important person for many, many reasons, but especially that.
Well, so. I don't know about that, but I'm just having a good time.
And again, you'd never know it from talking to Dick, but in addition to everything that he's done, he's talked about here, he's a couple of years ago was inducted to the Wisconsin Aviation Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I don't know why, but I was very, very honored because of that. So many people with tremendous aviation backgrounds, and when I was selected to be inducted, I was I'm truly very honored and humbled with being selected to be part of the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was an honor to be there when that happened a couple of years ago. So, with that, I think we've reached the end of our time. But this is another one of our wonderful aviation speaker series events at the museum. In another week, we'll be doing this again here in the museum. I think probably after the episode airs, but. Just make sure to check our schedule on that for all the interesting speakers that we have on a fairly monthly basis during our aviation speaker series. So, Connor, any other thoughts before we close out?
I mean, I think you probably already answered this, but I mean, if you could fly any one airplane from your career, fixed wing or rotor wing, I'm guessing you would say the Loach probably.
Yeah, right now I'd still say the Loach, but actually right now my favorite aircraft to fly is the RV-12. It's just a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a big world of difference there, but
I like flying it too. I'd maybe say the 6, but yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dick. Thank you for everything that you've done, and thank you for being here, and thank you for your comradeship here at EAA.
Well, thank you. Good talking to you. Thanks.
Absolutely. And for everyone else out there listening, we'll catch you next time when you are cleared to land on the green dot.